Hello, this is Paul Green, WGN political analyst and chairman of the City Club of Chicago. The following is a special edition highlighting the fact that the City Club hosted both Donald Trump and Mike Pence earlier this year and the middle of summer last year in speaking to the City Club and to Chicagoans. We were the only club in the entire nation that has both of them speaking. And what you're about to see and hear is how in a certain point of time, Mr. Trump, just after he announced, and Mr. Pence, who still was thinking of perhaps of running for president, what they saw as the giant issues facing this country. Perhaps what you could look for with Mr. Trump is the fact that much of what he said early on in his campaign is still the stuff he's saying today. It is remarkable that people say he jumps around a lot, but as far as immigration, et cetera, he is basically repeating what he said then, and let you all know that while he was speaking, there were 500 or 600 people across the street booing him and a line of police officers separating us from them. And we were very grateful for that. So sit back and enjoy it, because this is an exclusive that's only on WGN Radio.
It's an honor to be here. And I have to tell you, that's what I heard. I heard they had over 5,000 people that they had to turn away. So naturally, I said, why didn't you just take a bigger place? You would have made a fortune. But they didn't do that. This food must be very good to stay here. But I guess it's a long-term tradition. But to be record-setting is always something I enjoy. You know, it's very... See that? Took a little while. Took a little while. It's very interesting because I've been doing this situation for a week and a half, 2 weeks. And it's been... I've really enjoyed it, actually. I've gotten to meet so many incredible people in New Hampshire and Iowa. I've been to so many different places, South Carolina, California. The other day I was in Maryland. We had a record crowd. We're having record crowds no matter where we go. And I think it's because I tell the truth. I don't need money. I don't need anything. I don't need campaign contributions. I don't need lobbyists. I don't need special interests helping me. The only thing I need is to do what's right for the country. That's all. Now, I don't know if that's going to translate. It might be translating because we've certainly done well in the polls. In fact, I see we're in second place, and I don't understand how Bush can be in first place, to be honest, because it's not going to happen. You know, when you're in favor of Common Core, meaning your children in Chicago are going to be educated through Washington, D.C., the bureaucrats, I don't think so. When you're weak in immigration, I don't think so. I've been very, very strong on immigration. Thank you. You're right. But I've been very strong on immigration, and we have to be. And I've taken a lot of heat, and it's unnecessary, very unfair heat, because, first of all, I love the Mexican people. I have a great relationship with Mexico. How can I not love people that give me tens of millions of dollars for apartments? You have to love them. But I love them for a lot of reasons. I love them for their spirit. But at the same time, we have to have borders. And this isn't for Mexico. This is for the world. We have to have borders. If we don't have borders, we're essentially not a country. And that's what's happening. Because you have illegals that are just pouring across the borders, hundreds of thousands of people. And it's a tough situation for our country. You know, we owe $18 trillion. That's going up rapidly. Very soon we'll hit the 19 mark. When we hit $24 trillion, that's like the point of no return. We don't come back from that. It's the magical number. And we become a large-scale version of Greece. And it's going to happen. It's going to happen soon. So we have to be very, very strong on the borders. And we have to be very, very strong on illegal immigration. We have to do it. We have no choice. Now, it's been interesting because I've read so many stories. I've never had stories like this. If I do a building, I get two stories. And not even that. I announce a big building and I get a little action. I announce Doral. Anybody go to Blue Monster? Pretty good place, right? The best. I took that. It was a sick puppy. I made it well. Now it's hot. We're building jobs all over the world. We're building a great one in Washington, D.C., right on Pennsylvania. We took over the old post office, Pennsylvania Avenue. It's going to be incredible. We're actually under budget and ahead of schedule. Does the government ever say that? Under budget and ahead of schedule. And it's going to be one of the great hotels of the world. It'll be the best hotel in Washington. But what I do is I fix things. I make things better. Whether it's Doral, which is this phenomenal, hundreds and hundreds of acres right in the middle of Miami. That was an interesting case. That was musical chairs. People bought it, sold it. Wall Street guys. They bought it, sold it. They kept buying it, selling it. Everyone buys it, sells it. They make $100 million. Then it got up to $550 million, and the market crashed. And I bought it down here. You would be very proud of me. But I spent money and fixed it and made it beautiful. And now it's one of the hottest resorts in the United States, and it's great. And a man came up to me from Doral, who was a member before, and he said, Mr. Trump, this is what, because it is beautiful. I blew it up. I mean, I built it. It's something really special. New clubhouse, magnificent rooms. The Blue Monster is brand new and incredible, done by Gil Hance. I did the other four courses. It was so incredible. And everybody loves it. And this member came up to me, says, Mr. Trump, this is what has to happen with the United States. And I said, you're right, because it's simple. Our infrastructure is crumbling. Our roads are no good. Our bridges are no good. I mean, you people have a big dose of it right here. We know, you know what I'm talking about. Our airports are a disaster. You fly into LaGuardia Airport, it's like a third world country. And you come out of Qatar, I go to a lot of places. You come out of Qatar and any place, I mean, China, Saudi Arabia, all these places, you come, you see airports you've never seen. Then you land at LaGuardia or LAX or Newark, and you see what you see with the potholes and the stuff that's falling apart and things that haven't been painted in 25 years, and it's disgusting. And we're supposed to be the great country. And we can't let it happen. We have to take care of our country. But it's very interesting because the press treats me, I get a mixed press. You know, I've always had a great financial press. They always treated me well. But the political press is different. And what I do is I went to the Wharton School of Finance. I was a good student, really good. You know, to get into Wharton's probably the hardest school to get into, or certainly one of the few hardest. And that was before anybody knew me. So it wasn't like, oh, great, I'm going to go. I have connections. I had nothing. But I go to the Wharton School of Finance, good student, really good student, smart. And then I go out and I make a fortune. And then I write The Art of the Deal. Who's read The Art of the Deal in this room? Everybody, right? Look. Most successful business book, they say, ever written. I mean, the greatest. So I do The Art of the Deal, becomes the number one bestseller on New York Times list for many, many, many months, and it's been great. And then I do a show called The Apprentice. Anybody ever hear of The Apprentice? And that was supposed to be a total failure. And in fact, I remember one of the critics saying, this is the most ridiculous thing I've ever seen, sister, because the sister's a big fan of The Apprentice, I was told, right? They said, this is the most ridiculous thing. Can you imagine Donald Trump? Now, to have a successful show on television, you need the women, because the women have to be much more than 50% of the audience. And this critic, before the show came out, said this show is going to be a total disaster, because who would want to watch Donald Trump, and especially women? The women will never watch him. And I say, am I so bad? Am I so bad? And the show became a sensational hit. Sensational. And most shows failed. 95-96% of the shows that go on television fail. And even this, I'm not doing The Apprentice. Because when I run, I'm not allowed to because of equal time. In other words, if I do the... I think it's a ridiculous rule, by the way. The politicians, you guys should end that rule. Go to Washington. No, it's ridiculous. I'm not doing The Apprentice. And you know, it's interesting. They renewed me. They renewed The Apprentice. And Mark Burnett called me up. He goes, are you crazy? You're going to run and you're not going to do... You're not taking a renewal. Everybody takes a renewal, which is true. You know, you have a show for 1 or 2 hours on television on prime time. And I give up. See, I give up a lot. So I give up The Apprentice and I give up hundreds of millions of dollars of deals because I'm doing what I'm doing, because we have to make our country great again. We have to. We have no choice. We have to make our country great again. So I go to Wharton, I build a fortune, I do The Art of the Deal, I do The Apprentice, and then I watch these political pundits, most of whom are not smart people. And they say, oh, isn't that terrible? Donald Trump, who's polling second. Can you believe I'm polling second? I haven't even started yet. But they say, Donald Trump, it's so sad that Donald Trump is taking the place of some senator who's like, give me a break, or some governor who can't get himself arrested. And I'm taking his place. like it's a terrible thing. So, I mean, it's really incredible. Then they call you all sorts of names. They call the clown car, you know, clown, like I'm a clown. You know, I'm worth a fortune. I built this great thing, and I built it the hard way. I didn't build it like with some internet site that, you know, some love site that's worth 600 million. I built it like with real estate and labor and people building and brick and mortar and financing and banks and everything and legal and, you know, the old-fashioned way. And I have some of the greatest real estate in the world. And, you know, it's something really beautiful about it. But now I want to do something else. And I really want to make this very, very special, what we're doing. So what I said is when I announced a week and a half, 2 weeks ago, I got such great reviews on this speech. I didn't use teleprompters. You know, it's like a friend of mine, Chris Christie, is going to announce tomorrow. And he's a good guy. He is a good guy. But one of the things he said, he's not going to use a teleprompter. And they made a big deal. I've been saying that for 6 months. I don't use a teleprompter. I'd love to use a teleprompter. I'd have one here, and I'd go like this. Ba-ba, ba-ba-ba-ba, ba-ba-ba-ba, ba-ba. And everybody's going to fall asleep. And, you know, one of those things, right? But you can't if you want to really. In fact, I came up with a statement. If you're president, if you're running for president, you shouldn't be allowed to use a teleprompter because they don't find out who the real people are. But you get covered very, very unfairly. So they never mentioned my teleprompter, but they mentioned Chris's. That means to me Chris will get good publicity. And that's okay. Let him get good publicity. It's not going to make any difference. Now, one of the things I've been saying, and I say it very strongly, but it's a positive statement, but they may. The American dream is dead, but I'm going to make it bigger and better and stronger than ever before. I say it. So think of it. Good. But I say it. And then I watch myself on television. So I say, remember, the American dream is dead, but I'm going to make it bigger and better and stronger than ever before. Nice, you know, statement. So here's on television. I'm watching it just a little while ago. Donald Trump was very hard on the country. And they have me quoted. The American dream is dead. Cut. I said, wow, that's a hard statement. That's a hard statement. So they give you a hard time. Then I talked about immigration very strongly. And then Univision tried to make a big political thing out of it. And the reason they did that, and who knows, maybe NBC will do the same thing. I don't even care. I don't care. Because I have to tell the truth. And the reason I'm doing well in the polls, and it's very interesting because I just got these, and CNN is back there live. I see CNN down there. So. But this is a CNN poll, just came out. And they have interesting categories. Who's the best on terrorism? That's a pretty important subject. Trump, right at the top. Who's the best on handling international trade? Like, not even close. Trump is like almost double anybody else, right? That's incredible. Then, who's best on handling the economy? This is from CNN. You believe it? Who's best on handling the economy? I like CNN, actually. I might not like them after the next poll. I like them this month, right? Who's the best on handling the economy? These are all different inside the polls, right? And the best on handling the economy, Trump by far. Trump has 29%. The next is like Jeb Bush. I don't think he is actually second best. I can think of guys that are better than him. Okay? So I'm best on terrorism, best on the economy, best on trade, best on, like, a lot of important things. The only thing I'm not so good on is, like, who's a nice person? Trump is last. I'm last. And I said to myself, you know, it's like, that's really fair. That's really unfair. Oh, who's the strongest leader? Let's see. Yeah, Trump is the strongest leader. So I look at this, I say, if I have all these things, why don't we just call off the election today? Let's put the country back in shape. It's true. They're pretty good categories. But I'm looking at what has to be done. And we have to get back to work. And we have to be less politically correct. And we have to be strong. And, you know, you take beatings. You really take beatings when you tell the truth. I've always said, and I've been saying it for years, And I really, you know, I love running my company. I wish this country was doing so great because we're building all over the world. We're doing a great job. My son's here, Don Jr., and Eric and Ivanka. You've all heard of Ivanka. And I have great children that are doing good. I have great executives. We're all over the world. We're doing. I would love to be doing it, but we can't. I mean, this is why they said, why this year? I said, it's just getting worse and worse. We're in a bubble. Remember what I said. We're in a bubble. We have artificially low interest rates, and those rates are keeping things going. And when those rates go up, I mean, I know you have a tremendous problem in this state with debt. When those rates go up, it's going to be a very ugly picture for the country because, you know, you're paying low interest rates. On top of that, the country's losing a fortune. This state is losing a fortune. And many states are losing a lot. We're in a bubble. It's artificial, artificially induced. And there could be a time where it's going to be a very unattractive picture. And a lot of things could happen that are not going to be nice. It's not going to be good. You look at what's going on today with Greece, the stock market's not reacting very well. I don't know what's going to happen. Who knows? I would think they maybe will make a deal all of a sudden. It seems that deals are always made out of nowhere. Something happens. But there's a lot of angst. There's a lot of turmoil. But you just go along and you just have to. Somebody has to come out and tell it like it is. I deal with politicians all my life. I've made a lot of money with politicians. They're really easy to deal with. And now, with the exception of the folks in this room, because you have some politicians in this room, they're outstanding, every one of them. But other than the ones in this room, politicians are all talk and no action. They're all talk and no action. And we're never going to get to the promised land. It's not going to happen. You need people that are going to be truthful. You need people that are really smart and really know what they're doing. And when I said during my speech a week and a half ago that I'm rich, that was another one. They cut me off. I'm really rich. But I didn't say. I said I'm really rich. And you have to be. That's the mindset that the country needs. I'm not saying rich in a braggadocious way. I'm saying rich because that's the mindset that the country needs. So that was another one. Just like I said, you know, before, this was another cutoff. I'm really rich. But they didn't leave the rest of the sentence. The mindset is, this is what has to happen. And, you know, you look at our country and you see what's happening. We don't have victories anymore. We just don't have victories. And I tell people, when was the last time, as an example, we beat China in a trade deal? They just lowered their interest rate today. You know what that means? They're devaluing their currency even more. They're devaluing their currency because they're killing us. They are killing us on trade. And I'm a free trader. I believe in free trade. But, you know, the problem with free trade is you need smart people representing you. And we don't have those people. I know who the people are. I know the best. I would put X person in charge of China. Believe me, we will absolutely do great. But China doesn't respect us. You know, I love China. I have people that pay me $25 million for an apartment. More. Am I going to dislike them? The biggest bank in the world from China, they're a tenant of mine. They pay me rent every month. And by the way, their lease just came up and they renewed. I said, oh, they'll never renew because nobody hits China harder than I do. And they come in, oh, no, we want to renew. I said, you do? That's nice. I mean, that's interesting. You know why? Because they respect me. I also have great locations. That helps, right? But they respect me. But, you know, friends of mine that are in the manufacturing business, they find it impossible to do business with China. And they get taxed. They send their stuff in here. And I buy it. I buy a lot of it. Because our companies can't compete. Look at South Korea. The other week, I ordered 4,000 television sets for a big job. 4,000. They all come from South Korea. And every time North Korea just rears its head a little bit, we send the destroyers, we send the battleships, we send everything over there, we send the aircraft carriers. To turn on the aircraft carrier costs $5 million. We send aircraft carriers, we're going to defend. We get nothing. We get all the soldiers over there. I wouldn't want to even be those soldiers in the middle of that. But we get nothing. Saudi Arabia makes $1 billion a day, We lose money. Saudi Arabia is so rich. They have the third most expensive, they spend third in terms of the military in the world. They spend, they're number three in spending. Now, I don't know if their soldiers are going to run if there's a shot fired. We'll see, because you never know. I tell you what, in Kuwait, when they were having the problem with Iraq, if you remember, the shots were fired and they ran. And we had our beautiful Marines standing right behind them, and our Marines took care of the business, right? But, and I was just given, we were just talking, I was just given one of the highest awards that the Marines give last week at the Waldorf Astoria. They gave me an award on, it was a wonderful thing. And actually, the gentleman, the general that gave it to me, just became the head of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and he's a very impressive guy. But the Marines took care of business. But if Saudi Arabia is making $1 billion a day, and you take a look at Yemen, where we have a border that doesn't end. The border is on Saudi Arabia. Do you think they're after Yemen? They're after the oil. They're not stopping at Yemen. And yet we get nothing. Why are we not getting it? I don't want to be sound like a mercenary. But why aren't they helping out? Why aren't they doing something for us? Because without us, they wouldn't be there for 10 minutes. They have the biggest planes in the world. They have the biggest yachts in the world. They have the biggest. And without us, they're gone. It's like years ago with Kuwait. So Saddam Hussein, Iraq takes over Kuwait. That's it. The head people moved to London, most of them. Many of them took whole hotels. They didn't take a room. You know, we take a room. They took five floors. They took a whole building. They lived. We went in, beat the hell out of Iraq, and then we let everybody move back. We got nothing. And then a guy comes to my office. I'll never forget it. The Kuwaiti investment. And we were talking about doing a deal. And he said, no, Donald. We don't invest in the United States. They don't like the United States. And yet we gave it back. How stupid are we? How stupid are we? So you look at Saudi Arabia. You look at Japan. Japan has cars that you stay in Los Angeles and the area, and those boats come in. You wouldn't believe. You won't say, how big are those boats? They get bigger and bigger all the time. Thousands of cars. Millions of cars a year. I mean, just, I never saw anything like it. They pour in. And I say, how much business do we do with Japan? When our farmers want to send stuff, they always protest and make it very difficult. How many Chevrolets are driving around the streets of Tokyo, would you say? What do you think? You guys smart as hell, by the way. What do you think? About three, maybe two? Different world. We lose with everybody. And then I talk about Mexico, and I love Mexico, but every time I talk about it, they accuse me of being a racist. And I have great respect for the leaders of Mexico. The problem is they're much smarter than our leaders. So you have plants going into Mexico. You have cars being built in Mexico. You have tremendous economic development in Mexico. You have a border which is very unsafe. I was really criticized for the border, but the truth is it's true. So I went out and we got stories. I said, do me a favor. You know, they think that, like, the way I said it was fine, but they made it sound like I was very tough. Well, then I got out. I had one of my people, do me a favor, just check the border. Is it, like, safe? I don't know. They come back with stories that are mind-boggling. So here's a story. So Univision's the one they pull out. I'll sue them. I'll sue their, you know, I'll sue them big league. I do fine with lawsuits. But they pull out. And you know what? Maybe NBC will pull out because, I don't know, maybe NBC doesn't have the courage to stand up and say, we need strong borders. They could be. Maybe NBC will pull out. I don't know. You know, because the problem with these public companies, they get a little bit of pressure and they immediately say, oh, gee, we can't be associated with that. That's the problem with our country. So who knows what's going to happen? But I send people out and I get these articles. Now, this was an article by Fusion. Somebody said Fusion's owned by Univision, right? Is it? Does anybody know that? Fusion is owned by Univision. And it's in the Huffington Post. Very liberal. They don't like me. They write bad stuff about me, right? And it was just the other day. And here's what it says. So I'm making tough statements about the border, how dangerous it is, etc. And that people, illegals, are pouring across. And I get this article. I get many. I have many, many articles. There are hundreds of them. How dangerous it is. But I'm supposed to. They think it's like Mother Teresa's coming across the border. Okay? This one says 80% of Central American women and girls are raped crossing into the United States. Well, I said drug dealers, I said killers, and I said rapists. And they made the word rapist. They really picked that up. But here's an article from Huffington Post and from Fusion, which you'll have to check, but I think owned by Univision. So I go through this and we go back to it. It's very hard for a very successful person to run for political office, especially for president. Because anything you say, anything whatsoever that you say, they'll call you names. They'll call you, you shouldn't have said this, you shouldn't have said that. And that's part of the country. And they don't even want to know the truth. And a lot of the public company stuff is very bad because these guys are running companies and they're afraid to do anything. But, you know, if for some reason the Miss USA, Miss Universe goes away, it's a very good company, very profitable, does great. I took it from a little puppy 14 years ago when it was losing money, and today it's very good. But who knows what's going to happen? I mean, you never know. But I have to tell the truth. I can't say, oh, gee, everything's wonderful. You can't say that. So when I look at the deals that are being made, and when I bring up as an example the trade that we're doing with Mexico and saying how Mexico's eating our lunch, I respect Mexico for it. I'm just disappointed with our people. We have the worst negotiators worldwide, but we have all of these terrible negotiators, and our country's getting killed. That's why we're losing money. That's why we have deficits. How about gross national product last week? GNP, below zero. That means we're becoming smaller. You look at China, you look at these other countries, if they go 7, 8, 9%, they're like devastated. We went below zero last quarter. Below zero. I mean, I guess it happens, but I never even heard of it. Is there such a thing? We're getting bigger, we get more people, and we're going smaller. That's called they don't know what they're doing. And I will tell you that if I win, I will be the greatest jobs president that God ever created. I will take jobs back from China. I will take jobs back from Mexico. I will take jobs back from many places. I guarantee you that Japan, which, by the way, just devalued the yen, will come across and be much nicer and much more respectful to us. Because you see, we have all the cards. We've rebuilt China. They're building bridges all over China. And I mean bridges that make the George Washington Bridge look like small potatoes. We don't build anything. We're not building. Our place is decaying. In fact, we have 60% of our bridges and tunnels that they say are unsafe. Every time I ride over, I read these reports, like 64% are in trouble. I'm driving over a bridge that's 400 feet over the water, and I'm saying, oh, I wonder if this one's okay. And so we have to do something about it because we have such tremendous potential. We have to take care of our military. We have to take care of our vets. Our vets are treated like third-class citizens, like third-class citizens. They build a hospital, cost like $1.3 billion, and it should have cost a fraction of that and been much better. And people drive. You have a situation where one of the groups is telling me where they literally have to wait 4 and 5 days in a waiting room just to get in to see a doctor, let alone to get fixed up. So our vets are being treated horribly. And they're our greatest people, you know, if you think about it. They're really courageous and great people. We wouldn't be here except for the vets. The military has a lot of obsolete stuff. We're getting smaller all the time. I'm in the real estate business, as a couple of you probably have heard. And all the time I get these listings for bases. And one day I said, how many bases are we selling? We're selling so many bases, a naval base, a this base, an army base, a marine base. We're selling bases. I mean, how many do we have that we have to sell so many? Because we've never been in a position where we're so vulnerable. The enemy this time is a different kind of an enemy. They're silent, you don't see them, and very smart, and they're better at the hacking. And they're better at the computers than our people are, which is shocking. And they're convincing our youth and other people in this country to do lots of bad things, and we don't even know about it. So we have to be much smarter than we've been. I mean, they're saying that China hacked. Remember, it started about 2 weeks ago, 4 million people in government. 4 million. It's a lot of people. But now they're saying it could be 30 to 34 million people. I didn't know we had that many people in government. They hacked everybody. Now, it might not be China, it might be Russia. You know, this country's so set on China. But it might be Russia. I say, why is it China? They have no idea. We're not doing anything about it. And yet, the St. Louis Cardinals baseball team is under investigation for hacking the Houston Astros, okay? No, no, think of it. Did you read that story? It's like the big story, St. Louis Cardinals. Who the hell? I mean, look, it's wonderful. Let them do whatever they want. So they'll end up getting a pitcher. He'll end up being no good. He'll need Tommy John surgery, right? But here we are. We know nothing about what's going on. Nothing. We know nothing about what's going on. We're being hacked at the level of probably 30 to 34 million people, and we're worried about the St. Louis Cardinals and the Houston Astros. It's incredible. It's incredible. So we have to straighten out our thinking. We have to create something again. We have to create incentive. We have to be a cheerleader for the country. You know, one of the things I loved about Ronald Reagan, he was a friend of mine, and I was a young guy. He was a much older guy, obviously, but he liked me. He went around to one group. He said, that guy's really smart. And at that time, you know, he didn't really know too much about me. But he said, that guy's really smart. He told him, maybe my friend made it up. I don't know, possibly. But Ronald Reagan liked me and I liked him. But he had something that was really great. He was like a cheerleader for the country. You know, there was like spirit. My daughter Ivanka, her mother and grandparents lived in Czechoslovakia when it was a communist country. And she'd go there in the summers for a month and would go with Don and Eric, sometimes separately. And she told me the story the other day. I never heard it. She said, you know, Dad, when I was a little girl growing up, I'm in a communist country, seeing my grandparents. And the people in the country, smart people, hard workers, they had little $1 bills posted onto their windshield. And they were so proud. And all the cars had it. They had $1 bills or $10 bills or anything American, but they had anything from the United States. They just wanted it. And she would say, you'd always see at least a dollar bill, and sometimes it would be a $10 bill, scotch taped onto their windshield of the car. They were so proud of just having that and having that little association with our country. You don't see that anymore. Today we're a laughing stock, we're a joke, we're all a bunch of clowns. Putin has no respect for us. I had the Miss Universe contest over there 2 years ago. I got to know these guys well. We can get along with them well. We can get along with them well. But Putin has no respect for us. He hates the president, hates him. Hates him with a passion. But no reason for it. There's no reason for it. And we fight for Ukraine, and I'm saying it's all fine. But why isn't Germany? Germany's making a fortune. It's one of the most prosperous nations in the world. And you have other countries. They're not fighting. We're fighting over the Ukraine. We're fighting for them. Why aren't they doing it? Now, I'm not saying we shouldn't be, because we should be helping them out. But why are we always leading the charge? Why are we doing that? So we can make our country great again. But before we do that, we have to make our country rich again. And we can't, because everybody is taking advantage of us, because we don't have the right leadership. It's as simple as that. And if I win, we will make it rich. We will make it great. We will build up our military. We will save Social Security without cuts, by the way. And we will have a phenomenal country again. And I just want to thank everybody. You know, I really feel badly. I was very upset with the groups from, who's the head of the City Club? Where the hell is he here? I said to him, my partner over here, I said, the hell? You turned away 5,000 people. By the way, the press will not report that. Are you going to report that they turned away over 5,000 people? They will report that. They will not report that. I guarantee you that. And I thought what we'll do with Paul and everybody is, while I'm here, we'll ask perhaps some people have some questions, and it would be my honor to ask. And this has been really a lot of fun. You're an amazing group of people and a great city. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much. Go ahead.
Just to clarify, Mr. Trump, when you have a business relationship, you stick to your deal, right?
Unless it's a bad deal. No. Yes. Okay. Yes.
These people have stuck with us.
That's true. I agree.
Through thick and thin. Sometimes very thin, right, Jay? Okay. Well, here we have a lot of questions, and some of them are duplicates. But since I'm the moderator catching all the heat, I'll ask the first question. August 6th, I believe, is the first debate. Are you going to be ready to share the stage with 9 or 10 Republicans and stay within the time limits and give and take, especially the take?
Yeah, look, I'm not a debater. You know, politicians do this for a living. I create jobs, I create buildings, I create businesses that have been very, very successful. And I built a tremendous net worth and a tremendous lot of things. But I'm not a debate. I don't debate. Everyone's saying, oh, great. But you know what? I think I'll do fine. It's common sense. Hey, look, it's whatever it is, it is. But, you know, politicians every night they go and they debate. That's what they do. They debate. They talk. Yeah, I guess I qualify. It certainly seems like I qualify. I think they're going to take 10, and I'm number 2 now. So I think I qualify. But to me, it's not about the debate. It's about getting it done, really. But I'll be ready. Yeah.
Great. Now, we have a lot of questions, probably more than we normally.
Well, we'll take a few less than that.
Good. On the other hand, you know, to get ready for the debate, you have like 90 seconds. So terse is not worse. Ed Mazur, board member. Mr. Trump, what point in your life did you decide public service was more important than making money? That guy right over there, in case you're wondering.
Well, look, I've looked at it for, you know, probably 8 or 10 years, seriously. I looked seriously at the last time. I was very, very, I think Mitt Romney is a really nice guy, but I was so disappointed in him and his performance because that was an election that should have been won. He should have won the election. And I don't know, did he choke? Did he not? I'll say this about Obama, and you have to give him credit. He was on every show the week before the election, right? He was on Jay Leno. He was on David Letterman. I called up Romney's people. I said, where are you? Where are you? You're getting killed. Where are you? And something happened. He disappeared. So I was very disappointed in his performance. But with that being said, I will tell you that if I'm the candidate, there's not going to be any choking. I will fight like hell to win it. And I really think we have a really good chance. Hillary, probably it'll be Hillary, although you see what's happening. I mean, you know, crazier things have happened. This happened last time. It was going to be Hillary 100%, and then Obama started getting crowds. Well, now you have Bernie Sanders is getting good crowds. And who knows? I think it's still going to be Hillary, but she's very, very vulnerable on many different things. So we'll see what happens.
This is from Christopher Anderson. Affiliation, you'll like that, Realtors. I think a lot of potential deal makers.
I see
you.
It.
Yeah. Would you name potential Trump cabinet members? Secretary of State and Secretary of Commerce, assuming you win.
Yeah. It's just too early. I mean, you know, I didn't want to think about it, to be honest with you. It's just too early. I get that question all the time. Who would you make Secretary of State? Who would you make Secretary of the Treasury? Believe me, we'll get the best. We'll get great people. But it's just too soon. We have to get there first. I don't like talking about things until we get there. I never talk about deals until they're done. You know, these guys, they talk about deals. Oh, I'm going to make this one, and they never happen. I don't talk about anything. I always wait till we get it done. So I got to get one thing done first.
Okay. Karen, is that Rector? Close enough. Public Health Institute of Metro Chicago. What are the most pressing public health issues that need to be addressed during the campaign?
I think we have to knock out Obamacare, and we have to replace it. It's going to be a huge problem. It's going to be a huge problem. Trillions and trillions of dollars. They spent $5 billion on a website. It didn't work. The IRS just asked for $1 billion because of the complexity. They have to hire tremendous staff at the IRS just to handle what's going on with Obamacare. And people don't know this about Obamacare, but it doesn't really kick in big league until 16. That's when it kicks in. It's going to cause tremendous problems. And on top of that, the deductibles are so high and the premiums have gone through the roof. It's just not something that works. So I think that's going to be a very, very big issue. And, you know, one of the things that Bush did is he gave us Roberts. It was him that pushed it to his brother. Jeb Bush knew Roberts very well, and Jeb Bush pushed him. And honestly, it should be the Roberts care, because 2 years ago he approved it. It should have ended. And now he could have pretty much wiped it out, and he approved it again. So I think it's going to die of its own weight. It's been a disaster. And doctors are leaving their profession. I don't know how many doctors you have in here, but doctors are leaving the profession because they can't handle it. I have one person, a friend of mine, who said, I have more accountants than I have nurses because of the complexity of it. So it's not good for the people. It's not good for the country. And we can come up with a plan that's going to be much better. It's going to be great for the people and much better for the country and much less expensive. And there are numerous things, but there's one in particular that could really work. Thank you.
Here is a very intriguing question. You may not want to answer it because you're not there yet, but, oh, no, you can answer this. This is from Ashvin Ladd. If the current cabinet members were on The Apprentice, who would you fire first? And who would be the winner? That's a pretty original question.
I don't know. You'd fire plenty of them. Look, you see what's going on. You could fire all of them. The EPA is a disaster. It's killing us. The EPA, the regulations that they're imposing on businesses are incredible. But I think I'd have to look at Secretary Kerry. He's our chief negotiator. He's getting killed in the negotiation. The deal with Iran is a total disaster. They are tapping him along like a baby because he's not a negotiator. And then on top of that, at 73 years old, he participates in a bicycle race. And he falls and breaks his leg. I promise you one thing. I will never be in a bicycle race. And you know, when you are negotiating, you should double up the sanctions, triple up the sanctions, go in there and really do a job. You should say, we want those prisoners back. You know, they've got four, used to be three, now it's four prisoners. We want them back now. They don't even ask for them. Plus, we're giving them hundreds of millions of dollars a month. We're paying them hundreds of millions of dollars a month. And when the question was asked to the State Department, why are we doing that? They said, well, one thing has nothing to do with the other. Do you believe it? And on top of that, we're fighting them in Yemen. Other than that, the negotiation is wonderful. So I would have to say Secretary Kerry. And I think he's a very nice man, honestly. And I would absolutely. I think Jeb Bush is a very nice person. But he's not the right guy. He'll never bring you home. He's never going to bring you home. Believe me, he will never, ever in a million years bring you home. But Kerry's a nice man. But it's that whole situation with Iran and the nuclear is absolutely a disaster. How about two more, if they're good? Okay, if they're bad, I'll do three.
Two more. Got two more. Oh, there's plenty here, but I'm picking out the more unique question because you're going to be having all these questions, you know, all the other stuff. Mr. Trump, it appears you have done more deals in your life than there are stars in the sky. I thought you'd like that. What do you consider your best deal? This is the City Club. We're not asking you.
Yeah, that's good. It's an interesting question. So it's not my biggest deal. I would say Trump Tower on 57th and 5th would be only. It's not my biggest deal by any stretch. I built buildings on the west side from 59th to 72nd Street, and I've done deals where I actually made more money. But Trump Tower was really, to me, and to this day, it's been successful from the day I built it. Right next to Tiffany, I bought the Tiffany Air Rights, and it's been a great deal. I mean, I've done a lot of great deals. Just, I'm very proud of the building we have in Chicago. I'm really proud. And by the way, the sign, I love the building. I will tell you. So I have to tell you this. So the sign, people love it. People love it. And I said that would be the Hollywood sign of Chicago. That's what it is. The other day, when I came here, there must have been 100 people in front by the river taking pictures with the sign lit up in the background. And people love it. And people that actually fought me on the sign, they fought me on it. They've now called me almost every one of us. They say, you know what? We were wrong. It really looks great. And people love it. And you know, one thing happened that was interesting, because as you know, the mayor put in legislation that nobody else can do that again ever in the city of Chicago, ever. And, you know, they called me and they wanted to know, what do I think? And I said, I fully support that legislation. Sure. Nobody else.
Last question, Donald. All right. He's on a roll, but last question. This is another very good question. Carly Hansen, what are your thoughts on environmental conservation and climate change?
I think the biggest problem we have is warming. But it's not the kind of warming you're talking about. It's nuclear warming. We have got to get nuclear weapons out of the hands of maniacs, because that's our problem. I've received, and I said this, I was over at the Chicago Tribune, the editorial board, before, and it was really nice. Of course, they'll probably kill me tomorrow, but these are mine. I remember when I said how nice. I had a lot of respect for the people I met today over there. And they asked me a similar question. They were talking about, you know, global warming, which is now extreme weather. You know, it was global warming and this and that. Every week they come up with an extreme weather you can never fail. Unless the weather gets really calm, that could happen too, right? But I've received many environmental awards, and the Tribune was so surprised. I get a lot of them, and I believe really strongly in clean air and certain things. But the biggest problem we have is nuclear proliferation. We have to stop it, and we have to stop it now. We cannot let that happen, because that is a problem like no other. My uncle was a professor at MIT, a very brilliant engineer, scientist, engineer, Dr. John Trump. And he told me many years ago that someday people will carry around a satchel, just a satchel, a briefcase, and the destruction that that briefcase will do will be mind-boggling. And I said, oh, Uncle John, you have to be kidding. You have to be, you don't mean that. He said, no, I'm not kidding. I was very young at that time. I was like 12. And he said, I'm not kidding. It is getting to a point that he was working on the Van de Graaff accelerator. It was a long time ago. But he was a brilliant guy, my father's brother. And he was talking about the power, and that was so many years ago. And today the power is far greater than even he would have thought. So we have to have the kind of a president that is respected where this can work out worldwide, because that is really going to be the big problem. And there is nothing more important. I want to thank everybody. Paul, I want to thank you. I want to thank everybody. This is such a great honor to be here. I've had a fun. So many of the people I know, and I've been treated so well and so respectfully. I have so many people that just have treated me so well in Chicago. You know, they loved when I came in. I invested a tremendous amount of money. The building cost approximately $1 billion to build. And as you probably heard, it got in Condé Nast Traveler and some others. It got Best Hotel in North America. It does great. People love it, and I'm very proud of it, and I'm very proud to be in the city. And I love the people of Chicago, and good luck to everybody. Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you.
I am honored to have a chance to address the City Club of Chicago, and I'm grateful for that wonderful introduction and that wonderful hospitality. I'm also grateful to be joined by a number of Hoosiers. I feel like I've having been introduced by the designated Republican that's here, it's nice that they let a few Hoosiers in the room. I do want to single a couple of them out. Senator Rick Niemeyer, Representative Mike Ellsworth, Representative Ed Soliday, and Mayor Karen Freeman Wilson of the great city of Gary, Indiana. I want to thank you all for coming here. Good to see my friends. And to members of the state legislature from Illinois, I'm honored by your presence as well, and just grateful for the warm hospitality that's extended here. I'm especially grateful because, you know, as Indiana governor, to be invited by civic leaders in Chicago, given our state's playful penchant to poach business from. Well, it's an act of grace on your part. I recognize that, and I'm all for advertising Indiana, but the caution, high taxes ahead, billboards, the attention, tax drop, state line 16 miles ahead. We've been buying a lot in the Crane Chicago Business Magazine. The personal favorite was "You had me at balanced budget." And the one that's if AAA is wrong, I don't want to be right. And maybe the harshest one is was in the Crane Chicago Business that said, "Envy is a sin, but moving to Indiana isn't." But so especially for that reason, I want to say thank you. Thank you for making me feel so welcome and letting other Hoosier policymakers in the room. All kidding aside, the truth is I have enormous respect for this great city. And it may come as a surprise to you, the bond that my little family feels to this city is real and it's personal. I couldn't help but do a little. I was a history major when I was going to school, Chris, and down on the Ohio River. Went to Hanover College. It's the oldest small college in the state of Indiana. We like to say it sits on the edge of the Ohio. It was founded on a bluff in 1827. It's been run that way ever since. Kind of worked its way across the room there. But as a history major, I couldn't help but pull from a speech that Teddy Roosevelt gave in April of 1899, before he would step onto the national stage. He spoke at the Hamilton Club. It was a few years before this, the City Club of Chicago would be started. But he said words that I think still speak into this moment today, and I hope they touch your heart. Teddy Roosevelt said, "In speaking to you, men of the great city of the West, men and women of the state that gave the country Lincoln and Grant, men and women who preeminently and distinctly embody all that is most American in the American character," he said, "you people of Chicago have made this great city. You people of Illinois have done your share, more than your share, to make America great." And Roosevelt was right. But I must tell you that my connection to Chicago is not just because of the immense history of this city and its importance, but it's also very personal. I really owe a debt of gratitude to Chicago that springs from my own personal history. When my grandfather got off a boat on Ellis Island in about 1923, he caught a train to Chicago. And he drove a bus in this city for about 40 years. Yeah, my mom and dad both grew up on the south side of Chicago, down around 55th and Honore. And in fact, we've got family that goes to school and lives and works here in this community today. And my oldest brother, who is with me today, who is a Loyola grad, wearing exactly the same tie I'm wearing. actually just managed to marry his daughter off into the Doolin family, and Greg and Suzanne and Chris and Lauren are here today, and they're expecting their very first child. We just got that word. We'll be extending that baby dual citizenship for Indiana and Illinois. But so it's very personal when I'm in this city. I feel very at home. My story is I was born and raised by two big city kids down in a really small town in southern Indiana. We grew up in a little house on 31st Street. My dad was in the gas station business, and we had a cornfield in the backyard. But in so many respects, particularly this time of year, the Pence family would find themselves in the back of a station wagon making the long trip up what was then Highway 31, making our way to the south side of Chicago, to hearth and home and family and friends. So it's a blessing to be here in this time of year with all of you and reflect on those deep memories. My story is I grew up in that small town. I took a degree from the aforementioned college. I studied law. I worked in radio and television, and then I went off to the Congress, fulfilling a boyhood dream of being the congressman from my small town. And then just a few short years ago, had the extraordinary privilege of being elected to be the governor of the state that I love. And I have to tell you, I served in Congress for 12 years, and if I only had 12 years left to live, I'd want to live it as a member of Congress, because that was the longest 12 years of my life. And I really want to talk to you today in the time that we have. Chris asked me before, he said, "What do you want to talk about?" And I said, "I really do want to talk about the promise of the states. I want to talk about the fact that, the truth is, we haven't had government as good as our people in our nation's capital under the management of either political party for quite a while now. But it's been different at the state level. in states all across the country, including in our state next door in Indiana. And I want to talk to you about that, particularly as your state now will move through a transition of new leadership in a time of promise and opportunity and a changing of directions. I want to reflect respectfully as a neighbor about our experience in Indiana and how I believe that that may inform all that you're doing here. Because, you know, we could spend our time dwelling on all of the list of failings at the national level. But I'd rather today focus on the promise and the opportunities of the state and to really, during this time for your state, encourage you and give you hope and maybe a challenge to step into this moment. In a word, I want you to be encouraged. Because as much as we love competition here in the Big Ten, basketball, football, jobs, right? I truly do believe in my heart of heart that the Midwest holds the key to a boundless American future in this century. The heartland is where we make things and we grow things. And when the Midwest is working, America is growing. There's an old proverb that says, iron sharpens iron. So one person sharpens another. And I think what's true of people is also true of states and of governments. And it is my fond hope that as you look next door, you'll sense that sharpening and the opportunity. Because I think that's happening here in the heartland of the country as common sense reform principles have been being put into effect. You see, I come from what we like to call a state that works. We have a balanced budget, AAA bond rating. We've been able to increase funding for roads and schools at the same time that I signed into law the largest state tax cut in Indiana history. We now have the largest educational voucher program in the United States of America, 75 charter schools, and the results speak for themselves. Test scores are up, graduation rates are up, and in the recent Nation's Report Card, noted as the NAEP, we had the second best improvement of any state in the country, right after Tennessee, in math and reading scores for fourth and eighth graders. Now, I didn't come here to brag on Indiana. I didn't just come here to brag on Indiana. But I really came to encourage you and encourage you with the progress that's being made in our state and in other similarly led states around the country and to urge you in this great city with its great and rich history in this time of transition and progress to go and do likewise. Because I will tell you, it is central to my thinking, after 12 years in Congress and 2 years as governor of the great state of Indiana, I truly believe that the cure for what ails this country will come more from our nation's state capitals than it ever will from our nation's capital. But to accomplish that, we've got to do a couple of things, and I want to leave you with that word today. First, I think we as a people here in the heartland need to wean ourselves off of that kind of Washington-centered notion that every problem should find its solution in Washington, D.C. I mean, I have to tell you that I really do believe people all across this country are tired of the Washington knows best mentality that we've sensed really under leadership of both parties in recent years. You know, Ronald Reagan probably said it best, and yes, I know where he's from. And it ain't California. Ronald Reagan said in his first inaugural address, one of the first things he said to the American people was that it was important to remember that the states created the federal government. The federal government didn't create the states. And he said that he was going to make it his intention, the very first thing he told the American people was he was going to make it his intention to restore the proper balance between the rights afforded and responsibilities of the national government and those reserved to the states and to the people. This principle of federalism was truly central to President Reagan. And I believe it needs to be central to the national debate today in this country. Because In the last 75 years, it's probably accurate to say that state governments in many respects, according to policymakers in Washington, have been relegated in some measure to territorial outposts of the national government. But that's not what they were designed to be. I mean, states were really designed to be those laboratories of innovation and reform and creativity, where good ideas could rise and flow. You know, I'll never forget when I first learned that President Reagan had come in 1982, about a year after his inaugural address, to speak as the only president to ever speak before the Indiana General Assembly. He came and he spoke on one topic, and that was federalism. And the speech itself now appears on the wall in our General Assembly, and it holds up to this very day. It's a powerful speech. And he came and he announced a federalism commission in the first year in office. He recommended some 36 different federal programs that could be extended back down to the states with both the resources and the flexibility to innovate. And I came to find out that he actually made that speech in other state legislatures around the country during that time. I made my way to see his old attorney general and his old friend Ed Meese in Washington before I got elected governor. And I sat down with General Meese. And I said, I wanted to ask you about a speech that President Reagan gave in Indianapolis in 1982 on federalism. I said, you probably don't remember it. He said, Mike, I remember it like it was yesterday. I said, really? And I said, well, what was that about? He just wanted to give a speech on that, so we're going through Indianapolis. And he said, no, he looked at me and he said, Mike, he cared as much about restoring federalism and the prerogatives of states as he did about rebuilding the military and standing up to the Soviet Union. And I looked at him and I said, well, why was that? And Ed looked at me with a little twinkle in his eye, a man who'd been with him in his very first campaign in California. And he said, Mike, people in this town forget it a lot. But he said, Ronald Reagan was a governor. And he said, we spent 8 years in Sacramento holding our hat in our hand, asking people in a far distant capital on the opposite shore of the country for the permission to use our resources in our state to confront the needs of our people. So it was central to what he thought. And I believe it needs to be central to our national debate going forward. I mean, I truly do believe, as a conservative who believes in limited government and in the constitutional framework, that with new leadership on Capitol Hill and renewed leadership in Washington, D.C. in the coming years, we should demand not only that they put their fiscal house in order in Washington, D.C., but I believe that we should demand the new leadership in Washington, D.C. permanently reduce the size and scope of the federal government by restoring to the states the resources and the flexibility to solve problems for our people, our way, here at the state level. Now some say the next nominee of my party should be a governor, and I'm certainly sympathetic to that view. But all kidding aside, I'll tell you, it resonates with me, but what I'm listening for is not a person that says, send me to Washington and I'll go run Washington the way I ran my state. What I'm going to be listening for is that man or woman that says, send me to Washington, D.C., and I'm going to make it more possible for the next person running my state to run it with more freedom and more flexibility. That, to me, is the key. And that, to me, is something that's resonating. Second point I think we need to make, the key to doing all of this is, I think once we get our focus trained back on the states, then we need to start demanding of policymakers in both political parties that they craft solutions that will work and produce the results. And that's something we've been doing in Indiana for much of the last 10 years. We've been focused on making the hard choices and crafting real solutions that produce real results in the Hoosier State. And the truth is, in states across the country, and before the election, 29 Republican-led states have been leading the way in this regard. The statistics are kind of hard to argue with. Chief Executive Magazine in 2014 said the best states for business showed that 18 of the top 20 were states run by common-sense Republican governors, including all of the top 10. CNBC's 2014 top 5 states for business were all led by Republican governors. And Site Selection Magazine said the top 10 states for doing business were all led by the same. I don't make that as a partisan comment entirely. I really make that as an affirmation of there is an approach and a commitment to reform that's happening at the state levels, and with the election of Bruce Rauner, your new governor-elect, I believe can and should happen in Illinois as well. You know, in Indiana, under the last administration, we did a couple things in a row. First, we put our fiscal house in order. We made the hard choices to square the books. When I came into office, so we focused on job creation and building momentum. With unemployment over 8%, we confronted a struggling economy by cutting taxes, reforming local taxes, and freezing regulation. Unemployment was over 8% when I came in. Just 2 years down the road here, it's 5.7%. We've added 83,000 net new jobs in the state of Indiana in our first 2 years, and our labor force has grown by the fifth highest number in the nation. 65,000 people have entered the labor force in the state of Indiana. It's because we've crafted solutions that make sense for inviting investment and capital formation in Indiana in ways that create jobs. When it comes to health care, we're looking to expand access to health care in Indiana, not through government mandates and taxes, but through the principles of consumer-driven health care and personal responsibility through the Healthy Indiana Plan. And we're building the roads of the future, north, south, and east and west, and even up in this neck of the woods, we hope, in the not-too-distant future, with innovative financing through public and private partnerships. You know, I love to tell people that, you know, we got a lot of signs coming to and fro to the border, but on our sign, Welcome to Indiana sign, it says Crossroads of America. And I always tell our team at the State House, if you're going to say you're the Crossroads of America, you better have the roads to back it up. And in the state of Indiana, we've rolled our sleeves up and used innovative solutions. And also, we've expanded school choice, and I believe that before our legislature adjourns in the next year, Indiana will be well on our way to being the first state in America to make career and vocational education a priority in every high school in our state again. You know, that's something that your governor-elect and I have talked with great passion about. He shares that vision. Governor Rick Snyder was just reelected on very much the same pledge. But 2 years ago when I was running, it was interesting as I traveled around the state of Indiana, going in and out of businesses in a state with more than 8% unemployment. I thought most of the people I'd stop and talk to in businesses would tell me that there were no jobs available. When just as often I heard business leaders tell me we can't find people to fill the jobs that we have. And that's what got me thinking about the idea of kind of going back to the future. I mean, when I was growing up down in that small town in southern Indiana, we'd all park in the same parking lot when we go to high school. We'd walk through the same double doors. Some of us would turn left and go to AP English. And some would turn right and go back to what we call industrial arts. We ate in the same cafeteria. We cheered at the same basketball games, walked across the same stage. There was no plan A or plan B. It was two plan A's. And our schools worked for all of our kids, regardless of where they wanted to start in life, whether they were headed off to college or headed off to a career. And in the state of Indiana, working on a bipartisan basis, with the unanimous support of the Indiana General Assembly, we've moved legislation in each of the last 2 years to give us the tools to redesign career and technical and vocational education. And I urge you to consider that as well. I said at the top of my remarks, you know, here in the Midwest, you know, we do two things really well. We make things and we grow things, right? And so making sure that our educational institutions working in partnership with all of our post-secondary institutions create pathways in high school for our young people to be able to step out into life and start on success where they want to start, I believe is a key to revitalizing not only my state, but revitalizing a heartland and revitalizing our entire country. Now, lastly, I would say that, you know, Indiana is hardly alone in this push for progress and innovation and reform. I recited some of the statistics, but I would just say to each one of you that the opportunity to bring about reform and change at the state level is profound. I mean, the truth is the founders of this country created a national government that was almost designed to be hard to get things done. And state governments, I've found in Indiana, you're able to operate on the basis of consensus, bring people together. In Indiana, we like to say you make job creation job one. And the Hoosier State, we're focused on education, innovation, and reform, and having a four corners offense in our state. And we've been able to bring together people across the political spectrum to drive our state forward. And I have every confidence that our neighbors here in Illinois are going to be able to do that as well. But there's one other element that I want to close with today, and that is it has to do not with the policies, not with the focus, but with the attitude that we ought to bring to this challenge. You know, I ultimately believe that leadership is about setting goals and also setting the tone, right? And, you know, I like to say sometimes I'm a conservative, but, you know, I'm not in a bad mood about it, right? Right? Is that okay? I mean, you know, to be honest with you, I was... really drawn to public life and drawn to this party of mine by the kind of the relentless optimism of not only that Illinoisan who became the 40th governor, but names like Jack Kemp, who would go on to be a very dear friend of mine and a mentor. I mean, you know, all of you have these encounters as well. I remember I was at the Indiana State Fair this summer, and a man walked up to me, hat in hand, and kind of looked to the left and looked to the right. Circles under his eyes, lower lip quivering a little bit. And he said, "Mike, I'm all for you. I support you the whole way." But he said, "Really, you know, do you think the country's going to make it?" I mean, he had all the telltale signs of excessive cable television viewing. You know what I'm saying? Okay. And I just put my hand on his shoulder, and I said, "Of course we're going to make it. We're Americans. We always make it." Now, we'll let Winston Churchill get away with this because his mother was an American, but he said it pretty well. He said, Winston Churchill said, "A careful study of American history shows that after they've exhausted every other possibility, the American people always do the right thing." So let's be confident. Let's have faith. Let's have faith in the American people. I mean, I have to tell you, you know, I having worked out there in Washington a long time, there's an awful lot that's wrong with the national government. But we've got to stop confusing the national government with the nation. Okay? I would submit to you today that for all the faults that we have in government, the national level and frustrations we may have in government at the state and local level, that the American people today are every bit as good and decent and hardworking and resilient and patriotic and generous as they have ever been in the history of this country. They haven't changed. We've just got to have government as good as our people again. It really came home to me in an anecdote I'll close with. Chris mentioned earlier, I made a living in radio in the 1990s in Indiana. And I was literally on about 20 radio stations all across the Hoosier State. Best three-hour-a-day job I ever had. I was kind of like Rush Limbaugh on decaf. And but it was 1998. City of Indianapolis, which if you haven't visited recently, come on down and see us. You'll be impressed. City of Indianapolis dedicated a memorial to all the Medal of Honor winners in the history of this great country. It's right on the canal. And we actually had the great privilege for 2 days of having in town every living Medal of Honor recipient in this country when we dedicated it in 1998. And on my little radio show, I was able for 3 hours a day for 2 days to sit and to interview these extraordinary Americans and to hear their story. And one of them was Jack Lucas. Jack was from North Carolina. He was a Marine. He served in Iwo Jima. Jack's story was just as extraordinary as any other Medal of Honor recipient's story. He was in a foxhole. Hand grenade came in. It was live. He jumped on it. It went off. And he saved the lives of everyone in that foxhole. When I asked him during the interview on live radio, I said, not trying to figure out exactly how he survived it, I said, "Why did you do it?" And he said, with a shrug, nonchalantly, said, "It was my turn." Didn't hesitate. Extraordinary courage. Uncommon valor. And then our conversation took an interesting turn. And it's one that I'll never forget. I turned and looked at him. This was 1998. And so I was every bit of about 15, 16 years younger than I am now. And that much less informed. And I looked at him and I said, "Boy, you know, you're a member of the greatest generation. So I said, you must look around the country today in the 1990s and you're probably real worried about the youth these days, aren't you?" And all of a sudden, this very warm World War II veteran, his face suddenly turned to steel. And he looked at me with a glare. And on the air, he said, "Son, you haven't got the first idea what you're talking about." It was on the air. And I said, "Well, why don't you film me, straighten me out or something?" I was taken aback. And he said, "Let me tell you something, son." He said, those of us that grew up in the 1930s, he said, we partied every bit as much as kids do these days. We wasted as much time as kids do these days. He said, we were big as miscreants as some of the kids are these days. But he said, when the time came, we did what needed to be done because we're Americans. And kids these days will step up because they're Americans. And that's something you don't understand. Well, I was properly chastened. So time goes on. I ended up having the chance to serve in the Congress of the United States. My first year in office, I found myself on a sunny day in September on Capitol Hill, the 11th day of that month. I watched the billowing smoke rising from the Pentagon. I watched the horror of what happened in New York City and in that field in Pennsylvania. And then the next day, I saw lines on television going around the block in cities large and small all across this country as young people lined up to volunteer to put on the uniform of the United States. And I knew Jack was right, and I'd been wrong. He understood something about the American people that I didn't know then, but in my 10 trips downrange when I was in the Congress, when I visited soldiers in Afghanistan and Iraq and onboard aircraft carriers, I'll tell you what, the men and women who stepped forward in this generation and put on the uniform are as fine a military force and as patriotic a group of Americans as has ever served in uniform in the history of this country. And they proved to me. And they proved to me we can be confident. We can be optimistic. We can be positive. It's all still there. In Indiana, I hope, I say with great humility, I hope in Indiana we've proved that if you step forward, if you make hard choices, if you produce government as good as your people, the people will stand behind you and growth and opportunity will happen from your economy to your schools. And as much as I like good competition across state lines, it's my fondest hope that this is increasingly true in every place in the Midwest, including here in Illinois. I mean, let's have faith in the American people. And in this blessed time of the year, let's have faith in him who placed this miracle of democracy on these wilderness shores. Because I know he's not done with America yet. I want to close just by saying, on the foundation of the good and strong people of this state and this great city, with a willingness to make tough choices, to craft state-based solutions, I know the best days for Illinois, for Indiana, for the Midwest, and for America are yet to come. And we in Indiana look forward to the competition. Thank you all very much, and God bless you. And may you have a truly blessed holiday season.
Thank you very much, Governor. I've got a couple of questions. If you've, we've got these little question forms on your, and people will pick them up from you and bring them down. So let's get right to it. Mark Weiermiller, a member of the City Club, Governor, have you any advice for Bruce Rauner, say, on our pension mess, IRAs and 401ks? Is that, that's, there you go. Okay. That's Mark's quick question for the governor of Indiana.
Gee, look at the time. let me say, I mentioned your governor-elect. He and I have become acquainted over the last year and a half, and he is an individual of extraordinary capabilities. And I really have great confidence in his leadership. And I would just say, if Indiana is a model, the opportunity I think that your governor-elect has is to marshal the strength of this state, tell people the truth about what the reality is, and make the hard choices and find a way forward. It can be done. but it takes leadership to do it. And in the state of Indiana, we, you know, the, with soft revenues over the last 2 years since I became governor, we passed an honestly balanced budget 2 years ago. But quite frankly, with revenues off on more months than otherwise, we had to manage those resources to maintain our budget reserves, and that means making hard choices. So I think to the extent that that your new governor steps forward and just speaks the truth. I know the good common sense people of this state are going to be willing to come alongside, hear the truth, and move forward. That's the only counsel I would give, and frankly, I have every confidence that he's going to do just that. I haven't heard a round of applause for Bruce Rauner yet, but I'd take it. I'm very excited about his new leadership here in Illinois.
And we have an invitation into the governor-elect, and we're hoping to hear back this afternoon. Knock on wood. Okay. John Gates, City Club member. Now, Governor, this relates directly to your essay on federalism. John Gates says, the federal government has begun prohibiting certain recreational uses of Indiana waterways and Lake Michigan. The federal government bases its authority to do so on a letter signed by a prior governor of Indiana. Will you continue to support giving the federal government this authority, or do you support returning that authority to the state?
No,
well,
easy question.
Well, let me say
that.
Sandbag here a lot, okay. Let me say that we're, you know, working with our community leaders from in Northwest Indiana, who I referenced earlier. We just recognize the enormous potential that the entire dunes and lakeshore area holds in Northwest Indiana, and we're exploring ways to continue to develop that in ways that are going to strengthen the entire region. I would say, without making specific reference to John, your question on that policy, we are always interested, and will continue to be interested, whether it's healthcare issues or transportation issues or education issues, to gain the greatest flexibility from the federal government in the use of our resources and the use of our lands and our waterways. And we'll continue to pursue that. But working in a collaborative way, I'm very excited about what's happening at the dunes. We've got some exciting things happening that are going to be, we think, bringing all new investment into the area and into the state park area and creating even greater destinations. I've already talked to a number of people in the room who own places in Northwest Indiana and spend a fair amount of time in the year there, and we encourage you to encourage you with the word that it's getting better every day because of the great local leadership that we have, and we'll work hard to make sure our federal partners give us the flexibility to maximize that the Indiana way.
Okay. In regards to the Crossroads of America, we've got three questions about transportation that I'm going to sort of put together from Milt Sees and Peter Scozy, both members of the City Club, and then Glenn Campbell of Patrick Engineering. This question has to do with the Iliana Tollway Project. Thoughts from your side of the border, as well as what Illinois can learn from Indiana's use of innovative financing for infrastructure projects. Thank you.
Well, I'm very proud of the fact that our project on the other end of the state, the East End Bridge project near Louisville, was named the Project of the Year as a public-private partnership. We used not only P3 for financing, but we used a P3 to market the bonds for the bridge, and it is I'm happy to report to the legislators in the room, it continues to be under budget and ahead of schedule. And we're going to get it done and get it done on time. I think the issue of infrastructure is so key. I just think roads mean jobs. And while at least one of the questions came from an engineering firm, I don't really mean road jobs. I don't mean design jobs. I mean, if you have the right infrastructure, you can create an environment that will naturally invite the kind of investment that will take advantage of the fact that we are the heartland of the country. And so one of the things that we did in the state of Indiana this year was I asked a key logistics CEO and my lieutenant governor to put together a panel of leading experts in a broad range of logistics area, not just roads and bridges, but a broad range of logistics, and design really a 50-year plan in the state of Indiana to start a conversation with our policymakers. I told them first, this, you know, it's kind of like Christmas shopping. Don't worry about what it costs, right? Just tell me what you want, right? I just told them. I said, go tell us what it should look like. And what I said to them very simply was, 50 years from now, if you take a picture of outer space, I want all roads to lead to Indiana, right? That's subtle, right? So, I said, tell me what that's got to look like in terms of land and water and air. And we came up with a blueprint that is a public document and you can consider and look at. But I'm someone that really believes in that long-range planning is a way that you can begin to marshal a consensus around what needs to be done, because it is other than public safety. The education of our children, infrastructure has to be among the most important. I mean, taking care of what you got, finishing what you started, and planning and building for the future. I would say with regard to Ileana, Indiana's all in. We're ready to go. That's been a project that I know has been a source of some controversy here in the greater Chicago area, and it's been a subject of debate. It's gone through a few hurdles. I am not as aware on this side of the border of the issues that are being worked through, but I can tell anyone interested in that project in the room that we're ready to build it from the Indiana border forward. And when you think about the and this is a proposal, I think, that first emerged decades ago, that we would move some of the 18-wheel heavy truck traffic south of Chicago to be able to intercept with I-65, so that then we could begin to realize places like Gary and LaPorte and Merrillville and other places on our side of the border could begin to realize on even a greater potential for ease in commuting into the Chicagoland area is an idea, I think, at least we think on our side of the border, is an idea whose time has come. We'll leave it to policymakers here in Illinois and your new governor to sort through that. But if he asks you on the street, what did Pence say about Ileana, tell him Indiana's ready to go.